Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food, and it's June 17, 2014. I want to bring on my first guest, Steve Kaufman. He has co-authored Good News for All Creation and is the author of Guided by the Faith of Christ, Seeking to Stop Violence and Scapegoating. He's the chair of the Christian Vegetarian Association and the co-chair of the Medical Research Modernization Committee. He's also an association professor in the Department of Ophthalmology of Case School of Medicine. He is a retinal specialist and a partner of Vitreoretinal Consultants. Welcome to It's All About Food, Steve. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you.
It's been a while since we've chatted.
Indeed.
So you're doing well.
I am, thanks. And I saw your recent video. It looks like you're doing well as well.
Thank you. Well, you know, it's amazing where the universe can lead you sometimes. As I mentioned in the film and what he's talking about, I've been talking about a bunch on this program, where I was invited by a feedlot owner to participate on a panel about climate change and animal agriculture's contribution to climate change to about 250 cattle producers. And I went. It was an incredible opportunity. I was really overwhelmed with how nice everybody was.
You know, that's the thing. You know, it's been my experience that farmers, cattle ranchers and all the like are really pleasant people. They're outgoing, gregarious, and fun. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're nice to animals.
Yeah.
But at a superficial level, at that level, you know, they can be a very friendly crowd and a pleasure to be with. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're nice to everybody.
Well, but it's important to know that, because I think a lot of people shy away from talking with people that they don't agree with because they're afraid.
A lot of people will accept respectful engagement. It's not always easy to respectfully engage when you have strong passions about what's going on. But we should respectfully engage everybody just because, for two reasons. One is, that's just the right thing to do. And the other is, you're not going to get anywhere with anyone if you're not respectful towards them.
Now, I want to focus a little bit on the Christian's perspective, because you're a specialist in that field, and I'm always looking for different angles and different communities to extend this message about compassion and kindness to animals. And I think the Christian community is an ideal place for the vegetarian, vegan message because of all of the things that are taught about kindness and giving. Where's the disconnect?
Well, I mean, it's also important because so many people identify themselves as Christian and use the Bible and or Christian tradition as the foundation for their moral decisions. So although the secular case for animal rights is strong and the case for animal protectionism in just about every religion is strong, to many Christians, the only arguments or considerations are going to come from that faith tradition. But why is there a disconnect? That's a tough question to answer, but I can give you some thoughts on it.
Yeah.
For one thing, people like to eat animals, and people like to defend whatever they do. And so, you know, this is what people do from all walks of life. And so, to some degree, people fashion the religion to suit their needs. That happens in just about all religions. The curious thing is that there's this element in the Judeo-Christian tradition which is so strongly pro-animal, and I think that indicates that at least some level of consciousness, people want to be at peace with animals. They don't really want to hurt animals. They want to have animals as their friends, but at the same time, they also want to eat them. So there's a conflict there, which is one of the reasons why it's hard to talk about this, because I think a lot of people recognize that their value is not to harm animals, and yet their practice, a practice they don't wish to change, involves harming animals. Another thing that makes it difficult for Christianity to take a leadership role is that so much of Christianity is institutionalized. Institutions tend to be self-propagating and self-defending. And so if the people out there are saying, you know, we really do like to eat animals, then the church leaders are going to say, okay, it's okay to eat animals.
Yeah.
They're going to be very hesitant to take a leadership role for fear of losing members of their congregation. And so the interesting thing was that the earliest Christian churches were really home churches at best. People would just get together at various people's houses and discuss the Jesus stories and what that meant for them. Those were the first churches, and they didn't have buildings to support. They didn't have pastor salaries to worry about. So you didn't have those sorts of issues that bring in other considerations that make it hard for churches to address the really tough questions, social questions, one of them, of course, being the animal issues. But there's others as well that churches are hesitant to confront because it's just too touchy.
I'm wondering about institutions versus gathering at home and having compelling conversations and discussions, if one is better than the other.
Well, at least in terms of moving things forward and exploring new ideas, if you don't have institutions to defend and support, you don't have to worry about that. Then you can take more chances.
And
because the worst that happens is someone gets a little bit angry or offended, and you try to smooth things over. But, you know, in a church, if a pastor gets up there and says, you know, look at what we're doing to these poor animals, look what we're doing to the earth, we've got to, you know, change the way we eat, a lot of people are going to head for the door and not come back. And that's just the reality of it. They're going to go to a church that says, you know, there's no such thing as global warming, or at least don't worry about it. Your contribution is so negligible that you just do what you want to do. And we'll continue to serve meat at our events, and you'll feel comfortable here.
Shall I dare say that many of us are hypocrites?
Well, I mean, all of us struggle to lead the perfect life, and all of us fall short in that regard. But that doesn't mean, I mean, I think that hypocrisy is more when your intent is so much in conflict with what you know is right and true. But that people, you know, don't always live up to the ideal that they would want. I mean, most of us would say the ideal is to have a very low impact on the earth and its inhabitants. And yet there's other things that we like to do with our lives that sometimes have an impact on the earth. And so it's a struggle to lead a good and righteous life, in Christianity, as well as just about any other faith tradition and secular ethics as well, says, that's true, let's explore the questions, let's see how we can do the best we can as a community, as individuals and as a community.
Now, I know a lot of people like to quote the Bible as evidence of something that should be done or not done. Is there some compelling evidence in the scriptures that tell us about what we should eat and not eat?
Well, sure, there's a lot of different passages. I mean, you can obviously, as you're probably well aware, you can defend just about any position on anything if you pick certain passages, you know, and especially if they don't come out the way you want them to, you just say that it's metaphor, and this means that, and that means that.
There's a lot of leeway.
It's the heads I win, tails you lose kind of thing. But there are some passages that are certainly animal-friendly. Two that come to mind and I think are perhaps most central for those of us in the Christian Vegetarian Association are in Genesis 1, in which all creatures, as well as humanity, is instructed to eat plant food. And it's a world of peaceful coexistence, which is described by the Bible as the ideal. It's not a world in which we live in now, because there's a lot of animals that would not survive if they didn't eat other animals. But at least it points to what the ideal is, and I think many Christians would agree that we should try to live according to the ideal, even if it's impossible to achieve the ideal the way the world is constructed currently. Which is ironic because in Genesis 1:26, a favorite passage of those who want to defend eating animals and say God made animals for us to eat them, it describes how humanity was given dominion over the animals. But this was a world in which no animal or human harmed each other.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever was intended by the writer of that passage to communicate, it wasn't exploitation, abuse, or tormenting non-humans. It was probably similar to what, because of the same word, of what is described as the proper role of a king, who has dominion over his subjects. He's not supposed to exploit and abuse them. He's supposed to be a good ruler who rules with wisdom and compassion and is really a servant to the people and an emissary for God, not someone who's supposed to take advantage of his position of power.
And the king doesn't eat his servants either.
True enough. And then in Isaiah, the description of the so-called peaceable kingdom or realm of God in which the wolf will lie with the lamb and the little child will lead them, that passage was just quite well known. Again, it's an image at the end of time in which all creatures, including humanity, live in harmony and peaceful coexistence. So that's where you get a biblical ideal. There's a lot of other passages where animals are eaten or used, but that's a world in which the ancient Hebrews, it was the world in which they lived. They needed to use animals in various ways to survive. But interestingly, the Bible also puts restrictions on how animals are to be killed. For example, if the knife, it has to be a cutting of the throat with a single cut, and the blade cannot have a nick in it. So at that time, that was the most humane way possible to kill an animal. I think we can do better today, but back then that was the best that they could do in terms of killing the animal. And it was forbidden, for example, to cut off a limb of an animal and then pack the wound and eat the animal piece by piece, which unfortunately was common practice back then.
Mm.
But the ancient Hebrews said, no, you can't do that, because even though there's no refrigeration and even though that's a more efficient way to eat an animal under the circumstances, it was just so cruel that they could not countenance it. So, but it gives you an idea that the ancient Hebrews, although animal exploitation was permitted, they were doing their best to minimize abuse. And so the Bible does not endorse at any point cruelty to animals or gratuitously harming animals. And as Norm Feltz has pointed out, the biblical case for slavery is much, much stronger, human slavery is much, much stronger than the biblical case for animal abuse.
Are there different Christian communities that are more open to this vegan, vegetarian message than others?
Yeah, I would say so. Now, the Seventh-day Adventists, a lot of them are vegan. It's for health reasons, and they are have variable interest in animal welfare and animal rights per se. But they do think that, you know, we should eat according to the Genesis diet, which is a plant-based diet, and feel that anything other than that is an unhealthy diet. They've got a point there.
Mm-hmm.
And then outside of that, there may be very small sects or groups that adopt such a diet. There's a group called the Hebrew Israelites. It's a very small group, which is vegan. But again, I think it's more for health reasons and Genesis mm-hmm. 1, following Genesis 1 than anything else. Not necessarily animal protectionism. Then, of course, within Christianity, there's a lot of individuals. I mean, we have over 7,000 members in our Christian Vegetarian Association, but we come from all walks of life, from very liberal to very conservative. I'd say that the liberal Christians are more inclined to a vegan or vegetarian diet, but we certainly have a lot of very conservative Christians who are members of our group, and for very much the same reasons, theologically, and that it's just part of their Christian witness. That they feel that, you know, we're supposed to care for God's creatures and they can't participate in activities that are the exact opposite of that.
And what is the Christian Vegetarian Association up to these days?
Well, you know, we still distribute over 100,000 booklets at Christian events, concerts, revivals, and the like. And we're coming out with a new booklet. It's going to be a little bit more up to date with the way people read, which is
snippets.
I try to make it a little more reader friendly, I think that is something that will help our message be well received. And then, you know, we just continue to be a resource for people who have questions. We have a Yahoo groups called Christian VEG Yahoo group, where we provide information and support for each other. It's a moderated list, by the way, and so all the messages are respectful. I believe mm-hmm. the ones that are not. we're doing what we've been doing, and hopefully the message will get out there more and more over time. I think we're making progress in several fronts, in part because I think people are realizing that unless we change the way we are living, we're not going to have human civilization as we know it for much longer. And I think if anybody is of an interest of having children, they probably have a strong desire to see human civilization flourish.
Yeah.
So unless they've got their head in the sand, I would think that the wise choice is either do your best to help create a sustainable world or at the very least, don't have kids, because what are we giving them? I mean, if we really want them to inherit a world that sees inadequate resources to keep itself going, that's not a world that I would.
Yeah.
I don't want to be there when that happens.
Yeah, and you don't want the people you love to be there when
that
happens.
Point.
Yeah.
That's my point.
No. Oh, okay. You saw the film. I mentioned a couple of things in the film. One was the Dominion concept, which you spoke briefly about.
Right.
And the other, I don't know if it's in the film. I think it is briefly. I told my audience early on in my presentation that I don't believe in killing anything, and then
right.
I said, thou shalt not kill.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think that means, thou shalt not kill, one of those commandments?
Well, you know, these things are open to a variety of interpretations, and I don't claim to have the final answer. For me, it means don't kill anything, at least unnecessarily. I would say thou shalt not murder is probably a better way to translate it.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that you can certainly murder a non-human.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what was intended by the writer of that passage, I don't think anybody knows.
Yeah.
But for me, at least, it makes the most sense to see it as killing any individual unnecessarily. And obviously, the vast majority of the time when humans are killing non-humans, it's unnecessarily.
Right. Okay. I just wanted to know a little bit more about your practice as a retinal specialist.
Well, we treat retinal diseases like macular degeneration and diabetic retinopathy and retinal detachments, the sorts of things that retina specialists do.
Now, when we talk about plant-based diets and good nutrition, with some of those, like macular degeneration, there is a connection, is there
Absolutely.
Not?
Absolutely. And at least on theoretical grounds, a plant-based diet is going to be very good for you. I don't think there's any really strong evidence one way or the other about whether animal-based products are harmful to the eye that way. I mean, except insofar as if you get a heart attack and die, then you also go blind. But but just because that's what happens when you die. but I don't think it has. I'm not sure whether it has a direct effect on the eye. But certainly the plant-based foods are going to be good for you. And if that's and it's you know the typical American diet, I think is not optimal at all for eye health. Insofar as it's so much animal-based and lacks a lot of the. Particularly the green leafy vegetables are good for you as well as carrots, as you know and. You won't hurt yourself if you overdose on carrots, but you will start to turn a little bit orange.
Right. But do you ever get to talk to your patients about nutrition you're treating them?
Yeah. Oh, sure. But you know, I'm not in a great position to say you should be vegan. I can't really back that up with a lot of scientific evidence, but I certainly talk about the importance of moving towards plant-based diet and broader consumption of those and that sort of thing.
Right, because I know so many medical professionals are afraid to talk about diet with their patients, and patients need to hear it over and over and over and over from people that they respect.
Well, that's true. That's true. And particularly for a lot of other medical conditions, the case is much stronger. And we know that, you know, it's crazy that from Dr. Esselstyn and Dr. Ornish and work such as theirs, that the plant-based diets are the ones that are going to save their life. And not telling the patients that. Now, the patient may say, I don't want that, and that's the patient's choice. But the patients aren't even hearing, you know, there's a way that you can live. Some people find it difficult and some people don't, but you can survive.
Mm-hmm.
But they won't even talk about it. I think in part because it really does take a lot of work. And doctors don't have a lot of time now for patients. It's an unfortunate aspect. There's a lot of reasons behind that. And it's not just, you know, the notion that doctors just try to make more money. It's there's been changes in the way healthcare is reimbursed and run, ways that make it difficult for doctors to find the time that it takes to really give people the advice and support that they need. It's an unfortunate situation.
Do you have any thoughts on the current Pope?
It sounds like, you know, he's somewhat friendly towards animals, which is a nice thing.
Yeah.
But again, you know, when the followers lead, the leaders will follow. And so
they have to lead better.
But my point is that they're the way the followers have to be the ones to say we want different kinds of leadership, because as long as the followers are saying that this is what we, you know, this is what we want to hear, then that's what they're going to hear.
So
on the one hand, it can be frustrating, but on the other hand, it can be liberating, because leaders normally will want to be conservative, because after all, they got where they were through the existing institution. So there's a lot of potential for the grassroots who are not so invested in the conservative institution to say we want fundamental changes in the way our communities or institutions are run. So there's ways to look at that aren't so despairing.
The people have the power.
They do.
Yeah.
Which is probably a good thing, because if the leaders were the only ones with the power, they probably wouldn't change very much. After all, that's how, you know, through the existing system is where, how they got to where they are.
But I guess I haven't really looked at it this way, but it sounds like the leaders aren't really leading.
No,
they're just taking what they're getting and just going along with it.
I mean, after all, the Pope is just a human being.
Oh.
Right? the Pope only has immense power because a lot of other human beings have invested the Pope with that power. That's the only reason. I mean, otherwise, he's just another person.
Right, just another human being. Okay, well, before we go, do you have some wise words for us how we can move forward?
Well, you know, there's
on this planet of ours.
There's a Hindu saying that when you're ready, your guru will find you. I think that what we have to do is be that guru and keep on saying, hitting people with the message over and over again. And when people are finally ready for that message, then they'll say, ah, gee, I'm glad I thought of that.
I like that. I like that a lot, because for so many of us, it can be so frustrating to keep on with this message. But, you know, people need to hear it over and over again.
We shouldn't try to convert people. We should try to facilitate people converting themselves by asking questions, bringing up facts, not telling people what to think or do, but rather just to say, you know, this is what I do, this is why I do it, and then people say, maybe that's right for me. And so that because people need to feel empowered as well, and they need to sort of have a sense that that this is their choice, not imposed on them by anybody else.
Yeah, well, when I was talking to those cattlemen and women, those cattle people, I never told them what to do.
Sure.
I want to think that I did move some cells around inside themselves where they started questioning. And
yeah.
I like the way you put it, where at some point it'll be their idea to change.
Yeah.
Well, let's leave it at that. Let's make it everyone else's idea to make this world a better place.
All right.
Okay, thanks, Steve, for taking the time of talking to me today, and all the best to you and the Christian Vegetarian Association, and I look forward to that new booklet coming out.
Thanks, Karen.
Okay, take care.
Bye now.
We're going to take a little break now, and we'll be back in a few minutes. Stay with us. Hello, everybody. We're back. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. It's a lovely June 17, 2014, here in New York City. I wanted to tell you a number of things. Responsible Eating and Living, my nonprofit organization, has been in the news. So, in the American Vegan magazine, are you familiar with the American Vegan Society? Gosh, they've been around a really long time, and we are in their summer of 2014 edition with some recipes and a nice picture of the swinging gourmets. And I'll be talking about that in a little bit. And it was just really exciting to see that in their magazine. This is an organization run by Anne and Freya Dinshaw, and Anne will be back on the show next month. She's got a book out that was authored by herself and her father posthumously, actually. Her father passed about 14 years ago, and it's called Powerful Vegan Messages. So I'm looking forward to that. And then we were also in the San Diego Jewish Journal, a beautiful magazine, and one of our new recipes, a vegan gefilte fish for Passover, which is really a great recipe for any time of the year. It's a nice little appetizer. Is in their beautiful color magazine. So that was exciting. And we are in another magazine called Range, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit later, because first I want to talk about the Lone Vegan documentary, Preaching to the Fire, with my co-producer and director of that program, Gary DeMattei. He has over 30 years in the performing arts as an actor, director, producer, writer, and filmmaker. Gary, how are you doing today?
Hello, Karen Hartglass. How are you?
It's good to be talking to you on It's All About Food.
It is all about food, isn't it?
It is.
I mean, everything is all about food.
That's right.
So when do we eat?
I'm starving.
I know.
Okay.
How are you? How's everything going today for you in New York City?
I'm exhausted.
You are?
Yes, we work very hard at Responsible Eating and Living.
Yes, we do.
Yes, people may know that Gary DeMattei is the co-founder of Responsible Eating and Living, so we do a lot of work here together. Now, I mentioned...
always fun and joyous work.
Joyous work. Yes.
Yes.
Delicious, joyous work.
It is.
It is delicious. Now, I've been mentioning for weeks that there's this Lone Vegan documentary I was invited to speak to 250 cattle producers before the bull sale at a feedlot in Yerington, Nevada, and Gary joined me. I was the lone vegan, and Gary was my side dish, tofu.
Yes, tofu. And I called you teriyaki. which was a play on kemosabe.
Right.
I just wanted to clarify that for people out there that didn't get it.
Yeah, a lot of people don't get a lot of things.
Oh yeah,
unfortunately. But you know, teriyaki, even tofu teriyaki, is not always vegan, because there could be ingredients in the teriyaki that aren't vegan, so you have to be careful.
Well, I'm completely plant-based, so that would mean that I am the vegan version of tofu teriyaki.
So we went to Nevada, and I spoke to 250 cattle producers, and when we came back, we decided it was too incredible of an event, and we had to do a documentary about it and tell the story.
Right.
And that's where you come in, Gary, telling the story.
Well, first of all, as you mentioned, it's just making any film or piece of theater or writing about anything, you really want to have a good story to tell. And this was an incredible story to tell, and it shouldn't be confused with being a part of the Kickstarter reward, because we actually funded the research that the Lone Vegan had to do in order to talk to 250 cattle producers in Yerington, Nevada with a Kickstarter program. And what I really want everyone to know is that this was something we did completely on our own, separate from that, as sort of a Valentine to not only those folks that participated in our Kickstarter, but also to everyone else out there who maybe isn't familiar with this plant-based movement that seems to be taking hold quite vigorously throughout the world and has been for quite some time. So it was also just a really great story to tell about the movement and all of the hardworking activists out there that are a part of that movement, yourself included, of course. And then this incredible story about you actually going away from the fold, as it were, and talking to the folks that are responsible for producing the animal products that are consumed by not only our country, but around the world.
It feels a whole lot different preaching to the choir and preaching to the fire.
Yeah, and when I saw that as an objective, I wasn't objective, but as an observer of that, trying to remain objective, it was an incredible story that had to be told. So when a filmmaker gets a hold of something like this, you have to figure out what your objective is in telling the story, And you should also, and any good writer will know this as well, or anyone that creates art will know that they always have someone in mind when they're writing whatever it is they're writing, or when they're making a film, that they want to either be reading it or to be watching it. And those that I had in mind were those that maybe aren't familiar with the plant-based movement, with what being a vegan is, and how I think that sort of was reflected with why Lucy Snyder, who is one of the lead characters of this
documentary, the feedlot owner,
right, who she really wanted to have her people, her choir, kind of meet face-to-face, which is why I think her intentions were not to throw you to the wolves, but to actually have the wolves actually take a good look at you and see that you're just like them, and
well,
they
you know,
are just like you.
One of the things that amazed me was she really believed she was doing good things. She thought she was treating her animals well, and she thought if we would go and see the feedlot, we would change our mind about animal agriculture.
Right.
That really surprised me.
As you say in the film, it didn't change your mind.
It didn't happen.
No. And, you know, and I had a theory about that, too, that, you know, we tried to touch on in the film without really preaching, because I think it's a great story without preaching. One of the things that's interesting is that whenever I talk to folks who aren't vegan or don't have a plant-based diet that they've adopted completely, they always say to me, you know, and don't show me any of those videos or any of those horrible things from the slaughterhouses, because I'm just not going to look. It's not going to change my mind. I'm not going to stop eating meat. I just, you know, don't start showing me that stuff. And so who I had in mind when I was making this film was the audience out there that didn't want to see any horrific images of animal cruelty, but were maybe curious about taking the first step, because I know that a lot of times we can all turn off something that we don't want to see and not want to listen to the truth. And this is I swear in the film once, but I think for the most part, if you cover your ears at that one point, it's a rated G kind of experience the whole family can watch. And it's really a celebration of what good work is being done, not only in the vegan world, but also in more specifically in what we're trying to do at Responsible Eating and Living. And it was like a little Valentine to those folks that have been a part of not only It's All About Food, this great program that you are now in your
fifth year
of presenting all of these wonderful cookbook authors and nutritionists and doctors and people who want a better world, basically, and are hardworking. And this is really one of the only platforms that they can be heard. And so that's wonderful. So
I wanted to talk about you mentioned how people don't want to see these films where animals are being slaughtered because they're really horrific. So what we show is the feedlot, the animals, the cows and the heifers and the bulls that are in these pens, standing on dirt, crowded together, and this is their day-to-day life. No,
right,
they're not being slaughtered there, but their life is misery, and you see that.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, and I know that there's a lot of smart people out there, and I don't need to narrate why we did what we did, but what we wanted to show was, you know, they're taken from the pastures and they're put on dirt. And, you know, as you have mentioned in the film and on your show and in several other arenas throughout the country, if not the world, cattle should be grazing all day. And so what they do purposely is they put them on this plot of dirt so that they can't eat, and they feed them twice a day. And that really got to me because, you know, that was horrific enough just to connect the dots there and say, wow, I get it now. I get why they are on these barren strips of earth, because they don't want them eating. They want them eating what they want to feed them. And that, to me, seemed horrifically cruel in and of itself. And the other thing is, if you really do want to tell a story, it should be told nonviolently. Tell a story about violence I feel it should be told in a nonviolent way. I think there's just enough people out there that are smart enough to connect the dots to see what comes next. I mean, it's, you know, it's that little thing that's buried deeply in your subconscious that tells you, well, these are pretty cows, but they're going to go, you know, they're going to go off to slaughter, and then they're going to end up on my dinner table. And so I think this is always in someone's mind, because I think people are intelligent, and they give, and, you know, and if they say they don't want to see it, that to me is a sign that they really do want to know more about it. So hopefully they'll watch this film and really get an idea of what these animals go through, and without having to see the violence, because activism in and of itself is a wonderful way to get a message out there, but it can also, in and of itself, have a lot of violence attached to it. And
yeah,
so,
I want to talk more about that, because we see it all the time within our own community, this violence, this anger. If someone is promoting a campaign, a project, a vegan, let's say, and another vegan doesn't like the way they package it, then they start arguing and telling them what to do. Or another example is I posted this documentary on several Facebook groups, and I mentioned Robert Goodland, because
right.
we talk about him in the film. I've interviewed him on this show. He unfortunately passed in December. He was called the voice or the conscience of the World Bank. He's an environmental assessment specialist, or he was, and put out some wonderful articles. And there are some people that just don't agree with what he had to say that are part of the vegan movement, and they just get really angry about it. And there's it's great to have a discussion. It's great to have a conversation. It's great to have communication, but I'm not into the violence.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that was also part of what you and I had talked about with respect to telling our story, was we just wanted to have a conversation about what had happened, and so we brought it into the apartment, and we called it Tea and 3C, and we kept it very low-key and very real, because we wanted the audience to come into our lives and, you know, sit at our table and be a part of our group, and, you know, feel at home with what we were trying to say. And so, it's really important when you're telling a story, you go to the theater or you go to a film, what's wonderful is to sit around a table afterwards and discuss what it was that you just saw, if it had some sort of impact on you. And, you know, I think a nonviolent story is far more compelling than a story with a lot of graphic images of the horrific things that we all know are happening behind those walls in the slaughterhouses. And yes, you know, it's important to show that, but that's not what we're about at Responsible Eating and Living. And there are other groups that show that have the brave reporters that go out there and undercover and unmask these horrific conditions. But I personally feel that everyone knows what's going on in a slaughterhouse. And personally, as a filmmaker, I feel that I'm going to give credit where credit is due. People know that animals are being executed so that they can eat them. But what they don't probably know is that the amount of food that is grown to feed these animals that then get slaughtered and put on your table is ridiculous.
It's and so inefficient.
There should never, ever be a case of any nation going hungry, because, and what we also try to do at Responsible Eating and Living, as you know, is we try to take these simple ingredients of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds, and turn them into these wonderfully delicious products that people will realize that if they just got back into their kitchens and started cooking again, or even started to go to some of these restaurants that are now popping up everywhere that produce plant-based foods, that they won't miss meat at all. As a matter of fact, they'll start to wake up, as I did 7 years ago, and say, wow, I can't believe I actually thought this stuff tasted good, because it's really all about the marketing. And that's the thing everyone in this nation, including me, before I switched to a plant-based diet, has really got to battle, and that is the marketing, the tremendous amount of money that goes into convincing everyone in the world that these products are tasty and good for you and, you know, something that you are supposed to have because you've worked hard all day and now it's time for you to kick back and, you know, eat that 42-pound bucket of, you know, flesh that has this wonderful barbecue sauce on it. So, and the barbecue sauce is normally made with plants. So, you know, of course, what you're tasting is this groovy barbecue sauce that's really wonderful and yummy. And the stuff underneath is just salted and sugared and a lot of fat that, you know, you think is the real reason why you're eating it and that you need it. But it, as far as I'm concerned,
it's the barbecue sauce, and you came up with a great barbecue sauce that we use all the time.
It's always the sauce.
That's what the French made.
The French knew that, and that's why they took organs from inside a cow and that no one would dare eat and sauced them to this, you know, with this incredible, all these wonderful sauces and made them palatable, sort of.
Let's go back to Yerington for a minute. You were watching the panel and the debate and the questions afterwards. Did anything surprise you?
Yeah, everything surprised me. First of all, they didn't shoot you, and that was surprising. I was happy for that. And the other thing was that they listened to you, and they really got you.
They did listen.
They listened, and they appreciated you being there, proving that everyone is the same. And, you know, some of us are just caught in a trap where we have to do these things to make a living. And what you left them with, which was also really wonderful, was some ideas on what, you know, what industries are coming on the scene. And there was really so much more we wanted to say in the documentary, but we wanted to keep it to around 70 minutes. But you talked to them about a lot of products that you have also interviewed the folks that are responsible for these products on your show. Beyond meats and beyond eggs and things of that nature. But yeah, I was really surprised that they really, really listened and really appreciated you, and they all basically wanted to come up to you and talk to you afterwards. And I think there's a couple of things we say in the film that are very important. One of them is one woman asked you, where does God fit into all of this? And I think your answer was something that I thought was one of the objectives of the film, which was to say, well, why don't you explain it, because you're kind of...
Well, I think if people want to know what I said, they should watch the documentary and find out. There's
a
teaser.
That's a great idea.
So if you want to know where it is, I'll repeat this a few times, but you can go to responsibleeatingandliving.com and scroll down the homepage and you'll find a link to it. The link is responsibleeatingandliving.com/lonevegan.htm. And you can watch it at any time. It's 70 minutes. I would plan a movie night. And you can go to responsibleeatingandliving.com and look up our popcorn recipes and make some popcorn and watch the documentary.
Yeah.
But some of the other questions, you know, when I started my talk before the panel discussion began, I opened with a number of things, but one thing I said was, I get plenty of protein, and I get protein where your cows get their protein from plants. Because right away, I didn't want anybody asking me, where do you get your protein?
Right.
So I thought I covered that. But then they came up with, you know, other questions. You just can't answer them all at once, and they're always going to ask them. So they were concerned, would we get enough iron on a plant-based diet?
Right.
And could you grow enough leafy green vegetables if everybody was eating plants and not animals? And they really, you know, we looked at those mountains of feed. There was corn, there was brown rice hulls, there was ground up almond hulls that they feed these animals. And if you could replace those things, or at least feed those things to people, maybe not the almond hulls, but certainly the corn, and people were eating brown rice instead of white rice, they wouldn't have those mountains of the outside kernel of the brown rice to feed the animals. And we wouldn't even be growing the things we're growing if we weren't feeding them to animals. We could feed all the wonderful foods that people need to eat and just be done with it. It would be efficient, and we wouldn't be growing misery.
And another point we make in the film is that there are 70 billion, that's billion with a B,
land animals. That doesn't even include fish.
Right, that are slaughtered per year.
Right.
Per year, which was staggering. And
7 billion people on the planet.
7 billion people on the planet. So they're growing food to feed 70 billion land animals per year, which then get slaughtered, and there are 7 billion people on the planet. So if they grow, I think what we try and point out is that there's enough, we could grow enough food to feed the entire world.
You know, and people will give you all kinds of arguments. They'll say, well, the big chunk of that 70 billion number is chickens, although I think there are about 10 billion cattle that are grown, something like that. Anyway, the numbers are outrageous, and a lot of them are chickens that are smaller and die early. But we still could grow so much food for people and have lots of land left over if we weren't killing animals. And I just wanted to mention there was an article in The Guardian that came out today about chicken, and I think of my dad when I read articles like this. If you can't solve the problem, eliminate the problem. And the problem, they say, is it's about Great Britain and their Food Standards Agency, and they're recommending not to wash chicken before cooking it, because when you wash the chicken, many people may know this, if they have that salmonella in it, you spread it all over the place, you get it on your utensils and your sink and on your cutting board, and it wreaks havoc and spreads, and you get really sick from it. And it's the Campylobacter, actually, that's contaminating the kitchen. And so they're telling people, don't wash your chicken before you cook it. And I'm thinking, don't eat chicken. End of problem.
Right.
Crazy.
That's another objective of the film is, you just have to watch the film, everybody. You need to, because it's a great film. And we're bringing it around to different venues now, and we're entering it in different costs. I don't know if you say contest, but what you say. But
there are documentary festivals or submissions.
Right.
Yeah.
But we want you all to see it. It's our gift to you. It's absolutely free, like everything else we do online. And we keep our doors open at Responsible Eating and Living with donations from viewers like you. So
yeah. So, of course, we want to say that if you do like the film, we'd really appreciate your support with a donation, because we could use it and put good use.
And the other thing is what you were just saying is I think there's going to be a lot of arguments about a lot of different things, because that's what people want to do, is they want to find one little thing that they can then pinpoint and then blow that up and make that about make that all about the discussion. And we have a tendency to be myopic. We for some reason don't lose that when we grow up. But 70 billion land animals, whether or not they're chickens or cattle or
pigs, a lot of pigs,
not even counting the fish, are being slaughtered each year to feed people. And if you want to try and dispute that number between the chickens and the hogs and the cows, I mean, that's fine. You can probably argue about that. But just the idea that we have that kind of violence going on day to day here throughout the world says a lot about why there is violence reflected in other areas of our lives. So I think as soon as we start eliminating the violence to all of our own creatures, not just human beings, but all living things, then
it'll be a nicer planet.
I think it'll be a nicer
planet. Yeah.
And that's kind of what we wanted to say with the film.
Right.
Well.
Gary, thank you. Thank you for coming on the show with me today, and thank you for being the great storyteller that you are, creating and directing the Lone Vegan documentary, The Lone Vegan Preaching to the Fire.
My pleasure. Thank you for what you do as well.
Thank you. You're awesome. Talk to you later, Gary.
Talk to you later, Karen.
Bye-bye. Okay, that was fun. So, after the event, I was contacted by the editor of Range Magazine, the Cowboy Spirit of America's Outback, and I was asked to submit a 250-word article that they printed in their summer magazine. What I don't understand is why they limited me to 250 words, because you can't say a whole lot in 250 words. And they ended up giving me a full color page, mostly my picture, which, is flattering, but they included the 250 words, but they didn't quote me accurately, and so I've asked for a retraction. So what happened was they printed my 250 words. It's in their summer edition. I don't know if you can see it online.